You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon to all of you. Welcome to Brookings. My name is Tim Borsma. I'm the Acting Director of the Energy Security and Climate Initiative here at Brookings. As you all know, since June of last year, the fall of oil prices has captured political and public debates around the world. In this town in particular, I would say, a question often raised is what low oil prices mean for foreign political regimes. And countries that often feature in those debates, for reasons far beyond oil market dynamics that some of our speakers may touch upon in their presentations, are Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Now, it so happens to be, conveniently, that at Brookings in the Foreign Policy Department, we have in-house expertise on all these countries and their wider regions. And so, therefore, I'm delighted that we, together with the Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings, have been able to organize this event today, in which we can hopefully address some of the questions that you all may have on those effects of falling oil prices on these regimes. To get a better appreciation of the fall of oil prices, my colleague Charles Ebinger, who is a senior fellow with the Energy Security and Climate Initiative, will first talk about supply and demand patterns that have sort of led us to the situation where we are today. Hopefully you can also give us a forecast of what the price of oil will be in the coming months. After Charlie, I will invite Suzanne Maloney, who is a senior fellow with our Center for Middle East Policy, to discuss the effects of oil prices on Iran. Then gentleman sitting next to me, Mr. Harold Trinkunas, who is a senior fellow and the director of the Latin America Initiative here at Brookings, will discuss the effects of low oil prices on Venezuela. And then finally, Cliff Gaddy, who is a senior fellow with our Center for on the United States and Europe, will discuss the consequences of low oil prices on Russia. It so happens to be that today is also the official release of a book that Cliff wrote together with Fiona Hill on Russian President Putin. So if you haven't received information on your way in, you may find it on your way out after the event. After all interventions, I'll return to you for Q&A, and so we look forward to a debate. Charlie, if you want to lead us off.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this afternoon. I will say this month marks the 40th year I've been in the energy field, and I will say at no time have I been more confused about what both long and short-term trends may be. But let me hazard a few remarks, recognizing that they are said with great humility, and any one of them can probably be undercut by some other event, particularly in the geopolitical arena, that my colleagues will speak more about here today. I, for one, believe that the fall in oil prices we've seen to date is not temporary. It is structural. Now, we can argue where the new structure will emerge, but I think a number of things have been happening in the world market for some time that are maybe not getting enough attention. First, if we go back for the past 11 years, the reality, if we do a pie chart of all the different types of fuels there are in the world, oil has been losing market share. And despite continued prognoses by the IEA, the EIA, numerous oil companies, of a huge growth in demand between now and 2040, I would suggest that those may have to be reassessed. And the reason for that is, first and foremost, right now, clearly the crisis is exacerbated by the fact that we basically have falling or static energy demand in almost the entire world. We have Europe, you know, dealing with the euro crisis, teetering once again. Are they in or out of recession? Some countries may be moving in, some may be stable, but no real growth in demand in Europe. No growth in Japan. Falling demand in China, and I'll come back to that in a minute because I think there are some structural things happening in China that probably presage we will never return to the high levels of economic growth we've seen in the last numbers of years, and, of course, falling demand in other major energy-importing countries such as Brazil
Hello?
And India. So on the demand side, it's very difficult to see how we get any spark that's going to, on market fundamentals, leaving aside geopolitics, lead to a major resurgence in prices anytime soon. But keep in mind that people that invest in energy, I mean, this is obvious to all everybody in this room, but it's a point that we often don't say. People are not, for the most part, investing in energy production based on what prices are going to be today, tomorrow, or even 2 years from now. Some of these projects, like the oil sands projects in Canada, are 50-year projects, huge capital upfront investments, but very marginal investments once the upfront capital expenditures have happened. And that is to some extent true even in much more less costly things, such as our own shale oil revolution, because shale oil production can be pretty much go up very quickly, take it offline, and bring it back. So one has to be cautious. But on the other hand, we still have projections because of these long-term investments that we are going to, the EIA, I think, is now saying 600,000 to 700,000 barrels a day of new production in 2015. Met with the Canadians this morning. They are projecting by the middle of 2016, despite the current prices, another 500,000 to 600,000 barrels a day of oil sands. And when you consider, and then, of course, bits and pieces around the world and non-OPEC producers, and when you consider that most projections for the growth in world demand in 2015 hover around 1 million barrels a day, any of these things, if they come to fruition, combined with any of the 3.5 million barrels a day of production that's offline because of varied political conflicts, any of these things come back and surprise us in any unanticipated way, and we are on a downward spiral furthermore. And I think that is a more likely scenario than we're on an upward spiral back to $60 plus. In the interest of time, let me just conclude with some other dynamics that if we can step back from the current situation and look longer term, things that I think are transforming the world oil market. First, in the case of shale oil, we are now looking not at marginal deposits, what our geologists used to tell us, how far down the curve we could still find oil. We now can go to source rock. And that is a very important thing, because that means that if we prove the technology and find a way to do it, probably 70 to 80% of the oil that's actually there is at least theoretically capable of being brought out. We have aging populations in a number of countries, in Japan, in China, and as people age, they use less energy. We have biofuels. Whatever one thinks of biofuels are growing on an international basis and beginning to eat away at demand for oil and transportation. And this is important because keep in mind that 70% of most projections for the growth in world demand are for transportation fuels. We have policies actively discouraging driving in China because of air pollution. Some cities now you can only drive once or twice a week. We have growing environmental consciousness. While you may laugh at it, we now have people not just in the environmental community or the fringes of the environmental community, but we have people actively on Wall Street reassessing whether they should value fossil fuel companies on the basis of reserves, which if those reserves are produced, presage that we can never meet the 2-degree climate target that we all know we have to meet. And as a result, there are people actively saying that 50% of the oil in place and 30% of the gas may never be able to be produced if we are serious about climate change. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but this is a growing movement. So when we put this all together, I think we have the very stark possibility that OPEC is going to continue to pursue the policies they are. The Saudis are not going to move away from maintaining market share. There is nobody else on the horizon that can actively challenge them. I believe the Russians will continue to produce as much volume as possible, already exporting nearly 4 million barrels a day, a fact that often gets lost. And a lot of people are also missing the fact that with the decline in the value of the ruble, we now see the Russians actively stepping up their coal exports. They have now moved to the second lowest cost coal supplier in the world only because of the decline in the value of the ruble, ironically largely occurring because of our sanctions regime. So I'll stick my neck out and say, in the interest of time, I think we're looking at an oil price on the bottom, somewhere around the $36 to $38 a barrel level. I don't think it'll stay there because at some point in time, if we look at previous oil shocks in 86, in 99, in 2008, the low price itself becomes the engine for the big importers, the Indias, the Chinas, the Brazils, to say, okay, we can afford to start our industry up again with prices at this level. But time will tell. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. I'll turn immediately to Suzanne. Sorry.
Thank you. Thanks to Tim and Charlie for organizing this discussion today, to all of you for coming out in what initially looked like rain, but now looks like a beautiful winter afternoon. I will speak briefly in hopes of encouraging more conversation because there's a lot to get to with respect to both the broader energy market trends that Charlie just provided, as well as the issues for individual countries and regions. But, you know, the three of us here in the center who are addressing Venezuela, Iran, and Russia are probably competing on the basis of who's the biggest loser from these trends in some respects. And let me make the case that Iran is, in fact, the biggest loser from this sharp decline in oil prices. It comes, as you all know, at a time when the Iranian economy has been battered by years of sanctions, in particular the intensification of sanctions since 2011, targeting Iran's ability both to export oil as widely as it had previously done, as well as to repatriate the revenues from those oil exports. And so these sanctions that targeted the Iranian financial sector have had an enormous impact on Iran's exports and its revenues from those exports and on the government's own budget and viability. And I think that the fact that this price trend is coming at the same time that the Rouhani administration elected in 2013 in an explicit recognition of the fact that the financial crisis for the state and the political crisis in its relationship with the broader world was unsustainable, that the Rouhani administration is now challenged with a new set of crises on its agenda. It came in to solve the nuclear issue. They had a plan for addressing the economy almost irrespective of what happened with the nuclear issue. But ultimately, in order to grow, in order to sustain, to blunt the free fall of the economy that occurred in 2012 and 2013, what Iran needs is the ability to export its revenues more freely and to repatriate the revenues from those exports. And so this crisis comes at a particularly problematic moment for the credibility of the Rouhani administration at home. It's also problematic for Iran because Iran, in many respects, suffering as a result of the sanctions and the constraints on its exports, has been in a very beleaguered battle for oil market share. They're watching rising production coming out of Iraq, and they're very concerned about their own place within OPEC. And certainly for those within the oil technocracy, maintaining market share within the industry is very important. And so it's forcing them to engage, as I'll talk about in just a moment, in price discounting, in trying to match the Saudis blow for blow as they're dealing with the dropping prices. That is politically contentious within the country, and there's already a debate between what I'd call the executive branch, the technocrats, and those within the parliament who have a more politicized perspective on how Iran should be responding. Iran is also a relatively high-cost producer, at least within its own neighborhood. Its fields are old. Its fields require an enormous amount of technology and capital that Iran doesn't have access to as a result of sanctions. And so, again, you know, the margin for Iran is a whole lot lower than it is for the Saudis, the Emiratis, and others in the region. And so the sanctions in that respect are biting even further. And to the extent that the Iranians have been trying to mitigate the impact of sanctions, they've been relying on non-oil exports. But, of course, the definition of non-oil exports includes much that is dependent on the price of oil and the size of the volumes of their oil exports, including petrochemicals exports. And so we've already seen a considerable drop in the value of global price for petrochemicals. The Iranians We're counting on that rising value stream in order to help offset some of the reductions that they've experienced, about 1 million barrels a day off of their prior pre-2011 daily oil exports of about 2.4 million barrels a day. They're down to about 1.3 now, and at least 300,000 barrels of that is condensates. From the Iranian perspective, the leadership perspective, the response has been typically a lot of bluster. You've heard rhetoric from everyone, including the Supreme Leader on down, that this is in fact a blessing, that it plays into a preferred strategy of the system, which is to wean itself off of its oil dependency. This has been, of course, a priority of every Iranian government official and administration since the discovery of oil 100 years ago in Iran. And it's unlikely to be achieved except, as we see, under pressure of externally imposed restrictions on their ability to export and repatriate the revenues. The other point that the Iranian leadership is making, and this isn't really even an ideological point, but it's a sort of, I think, pointed reminder to the neighborhood that it's going to hurt the rest of the region and potentially the rest of the world more than it's going to hurt the Iranians. The Iranians, you know, despite the fact that they have a number of drawbacks to their industry, in fact, have a much more diverse economic base than particularly the Gulf oil producers. And so as a result, what they've tried to make the case, you know, subtly to the Saudis and others is that, you know, you don't want to pursue this policy too far because in effect it's going to hurt you more. And of course that point has been driven home, particularly by some within the security bureaucracy who said, we're going to make sure that it hurts you more. And we've seen veiled and less than subtle threats from those who suggest that, you know, if the pain becomes too deep, that the Iranians have the ability to close the valves of oil and cripple the economies of its neighbors. This is, again, a reminder to the region. I think this reflects a perspective that is both politically convenient for the Iranians to put forward and also certainly has some real resonance for the leadership, that what's happened to the price of oil is very much a Saudi-driven agenda and that it is in some way aimed at Iran's bottom line and Iran's viability as an independent state. I don't know if it's fair to say that this is the sole view of the leadership. I think that it's quite clear that the oil minister who was put in place after the 2013 election of President Rouhani and the return of many technocrats, that he and those around him certainly understand the dynamics of the market that Charlie talked about, the structural factors, demand, weakness, and oversupply that have contributed to this situation. And yet this fixation on the Saudi role and the Saudi agenda is one that, as I said, is politically convenient both at home and within the region, and something that I think does strike at the core of the Iranian view of the world. It also harkens back to some of their prior experiences. And here I would say and underscore that the Iranian response today is reminiscent of its prior responses to previous oil crises, most notably 86, but really you could look at 1982-83, as well as the Asian economic crisis of the late 1990s, and again in 2008. These are all periods of time when the Iranians have been forced to respond to sudden changes, negative changes, in their oil revenues in a way that has forced them to either engage constructively in a couple of occasions with their neighbors, and there I would point to the Asian economic crisis and even 2008 as periods where there was at least some cooperative management between the Iranians and the Saudis, or in other cases engage in much more combative fashion with their neighbors, and there I would point to 1986. So that is, I think, in some respects a very worrying parallel. The Iranians saw that crisis, which also had an enormous impact, devastating impact on their bottom line, as one that was driven by the Saudis as an attempt to drive Iran out of Iraq and ensure that Iran lost the war against Saddam Hussein. And in fact, it contributed at least briefly to an intensification of Iran's commitment to that conflict, and in many ways to a number of other negative regional trends for peace and stability in the region. But I would, at this point, I think that there are a couple of positive notes from the Iranian side. One is that there's a lot of things the Iranians can and are doing in order to try to mitigate the damage to their own economy. They very quickly, I would say publicly and dramatically announced a change in the budget basis. Iran's budget cycle runs around a March calendar year, and so The budget that was originally submitted last fall was based on a $72 a barrel oil price. And in January, the economics minister announced that that would be changed to $40 a barrel. I think this, you know, implies a level of realism. If you look at the structure of the budget, if you look at some of the decisions that the Rouhani government has been attempting to put forward, whether it's increasing taxes, cutting spending, these are all realistic responses to an economic crisis. Let me just skip to the bottom line, knowing that we have a relatively short amount of time here. I think the question for many in Washington is, will the oil price drop force Iran to capitulate on the nuclear issue? And I think that, as we've seen to date, economic pressure has helped to change the tenor of the conversation between Iran and the international community on its nuclear program, but it hasn't brought us to a resolution. I think that we'll see a similar trend with respect to the dropping oil prices, which is to say that it has an impact on Iranian thinking and Iran's worldview. And we know from some of these past crises that Iran has, in fact, made decisions to end major conflicts as a result of financial pressure. And there I would point to the decision in 1988 to accept a ceasefire with Iraq, despite prior assurances that would never happen. What I think is most reassuring about the situation in Iran today, the sole point of optimism, perhaps, in a talk that's relatively downbeat on Iran's current economic conditions and likely responses to the crisis, is that we're seeing a much quicker debate, a much quicker and more intense debate about the implications of these oil prices and what it means for Iran's foreign policy. When we're seeing it come from very influential positions, most notably from the president, Hassan Rouhani, who has been out in a very forceful and public way to suggest that, in fact, Iran's foreign policy and its domestic politics can no longer be run on the backs of its economy, can't use the economy to subsidize bad foreign policy, is effectively what he told a conference earlier this month. He also says in a very public way that Iran can't grow without engagement with the world. All of this has been refuted in an equally public fashion by the Supreme Leader, who, of course, has the decision-making authority over the nuclear issue. But it does contrast quite significantly with the level of debate that we saw in the 1980s, where at least at the moment when the oil prices fell the sharpest, no one was willing to go to then Ayatollah Khomeini and say it's time to end the war. Today we have at least the president of Iran and many within the system who are willing to say in a fairly public fashion that we need to alter our foreign policy in order to address this economic crisis. And I think that gives me some expectation that while I don't think we'll see a sort of political framework by March, while I don't even think we'll even see a comprehensive deal by the July deadline that's been put forward now, that there is a set of individuals in the Iranian leadership who are prepared to end this crisis, and that the oil price fall as well as the sanctions have played a major role in that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We'll continue straight away. Turn to Harold and see whether the bid of Venezuela and this competition that Suzanne was alluding to can rival Iran's bid.
Well, thank you. Thank you again, Tim and Charlie, for organizing this very interesting event. I think it'll be hard to tell which one of these countries is worst off as a result of this crisis. But one note thing I would say just to start off is, unlike what you just described about Iran, I think that one of the worrying things about Venezuela is that its leadership has shown a notable lack of realism in the proposals it's developed to respond to the present crisis. So what I'm going to do is take a few minutes to talk about Venezuela's situation as an oil producer, why this has been, the price drop has been catastrophic for it, and then talk a little bit about how President Maduro has responded to the crisis and what the prospects are for Venezuela going forward. So Venezuela produces about 2.5 million barrels per day, a level of production that's been dropping steadily but slowly over the past 15 years from a high of around 3.1 million barrels per day back in 1998. However, Venezuela does have the largest proven reserves of oil in the world, if you include its ultra-heavy Orinoco belt of production of possible reserves. Venezuelan oil does, though, tend to be heavy and sour, which tends to raise the costs of production and make it less attractive product. And so even as we're looking today at oil prices, as Charlie saying of, you know, possible as low as $40 or $35 per barrel, we always have to keep in mind Venezuela's oil sells typically for $5 or $8 less than that. So even today, checking Venezuela's oil has been commercialized around $40 a barrel or $39.5 a barrel. For Venezuela, we have to keep in mind that even before the drop of the price of oil from where it was over 100 last year to about 39.5 today for Venezuela, its economy was already in trouble. In 2013, it already had quite the highest rate of inflation in the world at over 50%. There was notable scarcity in terms of availability of consumer products. And this is when presumably the books were meeting on a more regular basis than they are today. Oil prices at the present level are really spell a disaster for Venezuela, because this is a country which derives over 95% of its foreign exchange earnings, over 95% from the sale of oil. And it's a country that imports over 70% of consumer products, including food. So dropping the price of oil has an immediate impact on Venezuela's ability to supply basic necessities for its citizens. Just to put this in perspective for you, every dollar the price of oil drops, Venezuela loses $775 million of earnings per year. So from 100 to 40, that's really been a considerable loss in income. And the other thing is, I think one of the things, that just doing a very cursory check, so I'm not absolutely sure about this, Venezuela has among the lowest foreign exchange reserves of any major oil producer, down around $22.5 billion. Keeping in mind that most of that is actually held in gold, so it's not not particularly liquid. That is really not only a remarkably low level, but it means it doesn't have much of a cushion to fall back on during this period of low oil prices. So let me turn now to talking about how the Venezuelan administration has responded to the oil crisis. Basically, President Maduro last month in January undertook a global tour with two aims. First, he wanted to coordinate with major OPEC and non-OPEC oil producers to see if there could be a coordinated action to raise the price of oil. And the other thing was seeking additional resources in forms of loans to help tie Venezuela and the Maduro administration through this crisis. Despite visiting China, Russia twice, Qatar, Iran, Algeria, he failed on both counts. I'm very doubtful that any sort of coordination among the major OPEC producers would produce a rise in the price of oil, especially considering the structural conditions that Charlie has described. We also know that despite the announcement that President Maduro made about receiving additional funding from China, Russia, and Qatar, that this at best consisted of promises of future investments by these countries in Venezuela. And in fact, the $20 billion or so that he announced in China was, it looks like, just a re-announcement of deals that have been promised in 2010 but not fulfilled. So it doesn't look like they were able to come up with financing to cover the gap. Folks who have looked at this more closely than I have suggest that Venezuela basically will be short around $8 or $9 billion in earnings this year at $45 oil, and obviously they're somewhat below that now. So what can the Maduro administration do? Where else can it go for money? Basically, their credit rating is just been downgraded again. It's practically junk. The markets are pricing the likelihood of Venezuela defaulting on its international bonds. It's near 100% by next year. So it's very difficult for Venezuela to go to traditional capital markets to raise additional money to tide it through this period of low oil prices. The Chinese, as I mentioned, have not been particularly forthcoming. They already have loaned Venezuela over $40 billion, which is being repaid by shipments of Venezuelan oil. I thought it was very interesting that even though President Maduro announced that he'd received $20 billion in promised investments from the Chinese have refused to confirm any figures. They have not backed up that announcement. When they were asked directly at the foreign ministry spokesman was extremely evasive and avoided making any specific numbers. So the Chinese do not appear to be have been forthcoming. There is talk that the Chinese had offered to buy some of the Venezuelan's heavy industries in the south of the country, steel and aluminum industries. The Maduro administration so far has not agreed to that. So the Venezuelans are basically starting to take actions that look increasingly unusual to raise additional money. They've taken some of the debt that's owed to them by the Caribbean island nations and started to monetize it. In fact, they basically sold off the debt that Dominican Republic owes them of about $4 billion for about 48 cents on the dollar, which is a great deal for Dominican Republic. And the Maduro administration got $1.9 billion from this. And there's some rumors that they might try to do this with Jamaica, which is another major creditor to Venezuela. They're in talks now to see if they can issue bonds through Citgo. Citgo is a U.S.-based oil company that's 100% owned by Venezuela. Venezuela's credit rating is so bad they're trying to use Citgo's credit rating to issue $2.5 billion in loans and then issue an extraordinary dividend back to Venezuela using the money from that loan. So there's a lot of, it looks like they're going to have to offer over 10% interest rate to get any offers on that. So clearly, I mean, this is quite great lengths that Venezuela is going to do this. They could, so what can Venezuela do if additional sources of money are not available? It also doesn't look like there's any easy way to increase production. Business conditions in Venezuela have been bad for quite some time. International investors who are already there are not particularly eager to invest more, especially because of the existing arrangements which require that the Venezuelan state own 60% of any new investment. The Venezuelan state doesn't have any money to put up its 60% of the investment. So that's not been very productive. There is a possibility that they could take the 42% of Venezuela's oil production that's sort of placed or allocated on a non-market basis, either repaying the Chinese loans or sent to the Caribbean island nations, including Cuba, or through domestic consumption. Venezuela's gasoline is about the cheapest in the world, and try to reallocate that. There is some talk of raising the price of gasoline in Venezuela from about 2 cents a gallon to somewhere higher than that. So that's another possibility. And, of course, the other alternative is to cut spending. And so we're looking at a situation where a country that already has very high levels of scarcity, inflation, 25% fiscal deficit, is looking to try to get control over a sprawling array of nationalized industries and state bureaucracies and social programs that have grown exponentially during the past 15 years. And I think that's really going to be a tough task for this government going forward. So I'm not very optimistic about Venezuela's ability to manage the present crisis. And the government has not really announced very clear plans of how to respond other than to say that they will consider raising the price of gasoline. They will consider adjusting the official exchange rate so that it closes the gap between an exchange rate of 6.3 to the dollar and the black market of 180 to the dollar, which is really an enormous gap. So they'll try to do something about that. And the third thing is they're planning to go after the distributors because they believe there's an economic war being waged against them. And in fact, just over the weekend, the owners of two of the largest equivalents of like Walgreens or CVS, the two of the largest pharmaceutical distribution retail networks were detained by the secret police in Venezuela. So they've definitely started on that part of the campaign already. I'll stop there.
Thanks very much, Harold. We'll turn to Cliff to hear what some of the effects of the falling oil price are in Russia.
Very good. I always like to think of Russia being a special case, but when I listen to Suzanne and Harold, I realize not everything is so special, but I think there still are some things. And, of course, these two countries aren't involved in a war in Ukraine, and under those kinds of sanctions for that reason. This is important because Russia is hit at this point simultaneously by the sanctions, the Western sanctions against its economy and its financial system, and the oil price, though, of course, the sanctions began earlier, and it's important to look at that chronology. But at this point, it's very difficult to separate what are the effects of the lower oil price, the collapse in oil prices, and what are the effects of the sanctions. And yet it's not really important to do that separation, I think, because you just have to see that they're together. And they have been together from the beginning, in a way, oil and gas and the sanctions. You remember that the sanctions from the very beginning targeted, in part, Russia's oil sector, not initially the gas sector, but the oil sector, banning all Western investment in Russia's Arctic and offshore parts of its oil production. So the idea was there to make that difficult, if not impossible, and to feel an economic pressure from that front. So that remains. Of course, probably even more significant in a broader picture of Russia's oil sector is the financial sanctions, and not just, I think we have to realize, these sanctions have really been damaging to Russia. Not so much because of the literal letter of the law, but because of the climate that it's created for all investors. The typical term that's used by Western investors is Russia is radioactive. You don't know exactly how the rules are going to be enforced. You're a Western banker or a Western industrialist. You don't know how these rules are going to be enforced. You don't know whether they will be extended and deepened. So to play it safe, you just stay away from Russia. You just don't touch it. And that's had huge consequences for everything in Russia, but among others, the energy sector. Now, Charlie's right. Russia's own oil production, which is really governed by its government, by the Putin administration, will continue to produce and continue to invest in order to continue to produce and try to find ways to do it. There are limitations that the sanctions have affected because of technology and so on, but they tend to be more longer term. So in the immediate short term, not so much. And the oil sector is strategic. The oil and gas sectors are strategic. They will be given priority. Everything will be done to try to protect them as much as possible. International corporations involved in Russia, not that many maybe, but important ones, have had a wait-and-see attitude, trying to protect their interest there. They don't, again, dare to do certain things that they might otherwise do without hesitation, but they're not just running and pulling out. Russia's oil sector, in all respects, is a very, it has a lot of momentum. It's like a big supertanker, very difficult to speed up, very difficult to slow down. It's not that marginal producers that are in and out. So Russia's oil output will remain very steady, likely for quite a while. And that's in high contrast, however, to the other aspects of the effect of the oil price collapse on Russia's economy. So let me get to that. Obviously, Russia can't influence the price, the world price of oil. Forget it. So they haven't even tried to do that. They have to cope with it. They have to figure out how they're going to mitigate the effects on the economy and society. As a whole, measured by macro indicators, with the exception, really, of this notorious case of the ruble exchange rate, which I'll get to in a minute, you don't yet see major effects of the oil crisis in Russia. It's just been too brief so far. Industrial production is not plummeting the way it did in the case, the historical instance that's most comparable, which is 2008-2009. And the oil price went from $140 a barrel to $40 a barrel within a few months. We're looking maybe at something close to that right now. And Russia's GDP in the year following collapsed by 8%. It was next to Ukraine. It was the largest collapse of any major industrial country anywhere. Of course, Russia had a booming economy before that. So if you even it out, it's a little bit more understandable. I would expect that if oil stays on average in 2015 at $50 a barrel, Russia might well see a GDP drop of around up to 8% in 2015. That's typically not what people are projecting quite that big, but most everybody agrees that there's going to be a shrinkage in 2015. Much more important, however, and this is what I want to talk about, is beyond some We hear and we look at and we would see in a Western European or a North American country, we can translate almost immediately a GDP growth or decline into how that affects people's living standards, sectors of the economy and everything. This is not the case in Russia, and it's especially not the case now, because you have a government which its whole mission, in effect, is to figure out how to allocate the shrinking oil and gas rent, the value from the oil and gas, in ways that meets its priorities. And its priorities are very clear. Its priorities are survival of the nation and the regime, security, both in the traditional national military sense and in other respects, social stability, which is part of security. And they're all sort of together, these, and sovereignty, you know, very much an acute issue for Russia, and ability to pay back, not be beholden to foreign lenders. They're all S's. I don't know, there's four or five of them, but I like to talk about them as survival, sovereignty, security, social stability. But those are the priorities, and that's the way the system will be managed. So in effect, what you have, and this has been the case, not only in Putin's Russia, but in pretty much every preceding regime in Russia and Soviet Union, as long as oil and gas have been so important for that economy across the board, much more than in the openly measured ways, it's all about managing those rents. Who gets them? And for what uses and what priorities? Russia is very dependent on oil and in many informal ways that you can't really see by looking at, say, GDP, the oil sector's GDP share or something like that, or the share of exports or the share even of budget revenues. So what in the long term, first I want to look at the big picture, the long term effects of oil price, low oil prices, Charlie telling us about could last quite a long time. What would be the long-term effects on Russia? And then I want to get to the immediate effects on what's going on. And I will conclude with a comment about probably what everybody cares most about, which is it going to change Putin's behavior in Ukraine, his foreign policy? I think that this crisis, this particular oil price collapse, may well have a very salutary effect for Russian long-term economic policy. We'll see. There's a fascinating debate going on inside of Russia right now. I've never seen quite so many opposing views by really, really competent people talking about how Russia needs to organize itself in the future. And don't be mistaken. There are very few people, serious people, who talk about the answer being diversification. The answer being that, oh, it's really simple. We are too dependent on oil. We should get rid of our oil dependency and develop non-oil-based manufacturing or other sectors of the economy. Smart people realize that's, you don't even waste time talking about that. That's never going to happen in anybody's lifetime that's commenting on it. So you have to talk about how you're going to manage that sector, and in particular, how are you going to manage the revenues from the sector. So it's now possible for the Russians to step back and look at the volatility of the rents they were earning from oil and gas as the price went up and down since, you know, the 90s and even into the 80s, and ask themselves, what would have been the smart thing to do? Well, they did some smart things, namely creating their sovereign wealth funds, their oil reserves. What some people have been saying all along, now more people are beginning to realize, is that we created huge reserves. They were up at a peak of $600 billion before the 2008-09 crisis. They're down around $400 billion now. They're still enormous compared to most any other countries in the world, and has served them very well in the previous crisis of 2008 and 2009, and certainly are serving them well now. But people are beginning to realize that we should have saved even more, and perhaps should have projected an average of a $60 a barrel oil over this whole period, and just been, you know, absolutely had iron discipline and forced ourselves to live at that level. We would have managed it. But that would have meant having oil sovereign wealth funds of about $1 trillion. It's not that much. I mean, it's not an order of magnitude bigger than the $600 billion they had. But that's the kind of thinking that's really coming into people thinking about it. If we make it past this one, we got to think about doing things differently for the long term in the future. Russia is not going to be a high-growth economy. I mean, let's just also dispel ourselves of that illusion. There's no magic bullets for Russia. It's not going to be able to find all kinds of sources of high growth that it had during the high boom oil years. It has some advantages, it certainly does, but it also has some real disadvantages of the legacy of the way it structured its economy and its economic geography during the Soviet period. And on balance, looking at historical comparisons with other countries over many, many cases and many years, I would say Russia could expect, if it did things reasonably well, to have a growth rate that averaged about 1 or 2% a year for long term. Of course, it'll be high years and low years and negative years, but I'm talking about net balancing out. And it's just good to have that reality. And again, there are people who are starting to think in those terms in Russia in the wake of this crisis. Now, that's for the longer term. For the current term, this is a real crisis mode in Russia. It is a situation in which the budget is being revised almost daily, and I'm not kidding. And that's conscious. That's the plan, is don't make any commitments at this point, even for the whole year of 2015, because we have no idea, as Charlie, you know, so eloquently said. The uncertainty is never been this great about what's going to happen, how far down the oil price will go and how long it will stay down and how high it might ever go back up again. The tone has changed tremendously in Russia. I was in Russia in late October, and I was in meetings with, including Putin, but also some of his top people, both on the economic side and otherwise. And that's, of course, before the oil price had started to go down, and maybe it was about in the middle of where it was down now, but there was still a sense that this is probably not going to last. It's going to go back up. They had coped pretty well with sanctions, they thought. There was a lot of complacency and even sort of a belligerent tone. That has changed completely. Now it's lowering expectations for the population, talking about how bad things are and how bad things may become. Last week, so-called anti-crisis plan was drawn up. It's been discussed daily, in fact, multiple times a day since then, in the sense of trying to figure out, you know, what of all this plan? This plan is sort of as Marxists used to say, this is the maximum plan. This is a plan at 38 pages, 60 points, all of which were supposed to be priorities. Well, you can't have 60, you know, priorities. So you have to figure out what's really the priority. But my sense is that's exactly what this exercise was all about. This is contingency planning. We have to figure out how we adapt and adjust. We will set overall priorities, but they will be very general priorities. They'll be the kind of priorities I just mentioned, all these S's, right? We'll have security and stability and sovereignty and so forth. How we get that, what particular measures will help us serve those ends is a different question. But in this particular plan and the preamble, they mention several things that are important. They mention macroeconomic stability. This is a country, I mean, these guys are such, you know, Tea Partyites over there. They're going to maintain budget balance to the extent they can. They're watching every aspect of that. They will meet their foreign obligations. There's no question that Russia will pay back debts. Other priorities will include defense spending, social spending, and then there's some token stuff about small, medium-sized enterprises. I don't take that all that seriously because there's no real way to measure that. Defense spending is really key. Defense spending, there was an enormous plan adopted over the past couple of years in Russia for, well, at the time, at the previous exchange rate, it was about $750 billion over 10 years. That's obviously partly about making weapons, but it's not. It's mainly about making jobs. It's making jobs in big, old, dinosaur Soviet-style plants out there in the Urals and Western Siberia, employing tens of thousands of workers. You got to keep those people happy, and others will sort of get on that gravy train for these defense orders. Russia's defense establishment doesn't really need all that much money to do what they've been doing in Ukraine. You just need little green men that are extremely well-equipped and well-trained, and then you have to have a bunch of nuclear weapons. That means nobody messes with you otherwise. Everything in between is like just the fluff that's needed to provide those jobs. But this is being taken very seriously as they're tightening down the way the money is being spent, who gets it. They're going to crush anybody who dares start stealing some of that money. This is going to be kind of scary stuff going on with the anti-corruption drives. Otherwise, the descriptions we had that Suzanne gave about the seriousness with which they're dealing with the budget, cutting spending, they will use some of the reserves, and the last thing I want to mention, because people don't always get this, but I think someone else might have mentioned it in another context, the devaluation of the ruble. This is a big difference from 2008 and 2009. You know, the ruble has fallen, its value has plummeted by half. The government has just decided that they're not going to support the ruble. This, by the way, is due to the oil price more than the sanctions. Nothing big happened with the ruble during all the sanctions. It's the oil price. And they have just decided, let it go, because we need to keep those reserves. We don't want to spend that money. So this is a strategic thing. So all of this, to answer my last question I wanted to address, is either the oil price collapse or the sanctions going to cause Putin to change his behavior? Well, the oil price, you know, doesn't work like sanctions do, because we say sanctions, if you behave right, we'll take away the sanctions. We can't say if you behave right, we'll raise the oil price. We don't have that ability. So why would he change anything about that? Only if somehow the oil price made Russia so incredibly weak they couldn't do anything. But I think I'm trying to make the case that that's not going to happen. So in fact, I think that there's not going to be any effect of all of this on Putin's behavior. I don't think it'll particularly push him one way or the other. It's important to look what's happening domestically and follow this discussion and debate, but as far as foreign policy is concerned, it's not going to have an impact.
Thanks, Cliff. Much appreciated. All three of you, thanks, all four of you. Thanks for your presentations. Before I turn to the audience, we got about 40 minutes for debate. I want to ask one brief question. Charlie, would you mind talking a little bit about the role of OPEC here? You touched upon it briefly, but the OPEC countries, led, I guess, by Saudi Arabia, UAE, Kuwait, basically taking the position we cannot control prices in the current market constellation. By cutting production, others, non-OPEC producers, will fill up the gap and we'll just use market share. Assuming that's right, first of all, your comments would be appreciated, but if we then look ahead to the future, if prices rebound a little, unconventional production is gradually, I guess, going to spread out around the world, what does that mean for the role of OPEC going forward?
Well, OPEC, you have to differentiate between, I think, the members of OPEC. If you're talking about, and the people who are saying this shows the demise of OPEC, the current crisis, I think are dead wrong. If you take the Saudis, the Emirates, the Kuwaitis, and the Qataris, Qataris, of course, much more in terms of natural gas, they clearly control the world price of oil if they wish to, because they are the low-cost producers. And there's almost no one else who can challenge them. And they also have the advantage of having huge sovereign wealth funds, so they can weather these prices. I know people come up and say the Saudis need $90 or $100 oil, not only for their own development needs, but for all the subventions they pay to various groups throughout the world, including wonderful madrasas in Pakistan. But the reality is they can win this battle if we got in a real price war. So I think you're going to see those countries continuing to dominate the market until, of course, if we can get Iraq and Iran stabilized, and in the case particularly, well, both countries, but in particularly Iran, and if we had 5 to 10 years of real Western investment allowed to go in, then, of course, the dynamics change dramatically, because then I think Iran and Iraq become key players in that market. The other ones, the Venezuelas and Angolas and others, are important, but they're also high-cost producers. And indeed, as fast as Angola, for example, has been growing, it's only growing at this point because of investments already underway. Most people think that Angola needs $60, $70 a barrel to continue what has been a very dramatic increase. Angola actually produces more oil than Kuwait, a great unknown fact to many people. So I don't think OPEC's dead at all. On the other hand, you've got non-OPEC supply, which we have continued before the current price collapse. We have continued systematically to underestimate. The EIA, the IEA, has always underestimated non-OPEC supply growth. And of course, we also have North America. The big question mark is if we get North America, if we were to get prices, say above $60 a barrel and believe that that was sustainable, then I believe we would see continued dynamic growth in North America. And in a sense, until we see a rejuvenation of supply, that would simply create, I think, a new price shock, because you cannot add additional supply in this market unless you have a tremendous growth in demand without forcing the price down. That's why the whole debate about crude oil exports, except among the diehards in the industry, has largely gone silent, because they realize if we lifted the ban on crude oil and actually put another million or two, we would see the price go down. So convoluted answer to your question, but OPEC's alive and well.
Thank you. Thanks for that. I'll turn to the audience. If we have microphones, I think. If you ask a question, please state your name and affiliation, and I would encourage you to ask questions and discourage you from extensive comments so we can accommodate as many people as possible. A gentleman here at the front, please.
Larry Luxner.
Larry Luxner, news editor of the Washington Diplomat. This question is for Harold. Given Venezuela's dire economic straits, what will happen with its subsidized oil shipments to Cuba and with the entire Petro-Caribe arrangement that's kept so many economies, not just in the Caribbean, but in Central America afloat as well? And more to the point, what does that mean for U.S. policymakers going forward? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. So Petro-Caribe is a program by which Venezuela has provided subsidized financing for shipments of oil to about 17 Caribbean and Central American countries. One thing to keep in mind about Petrocaribe is as the price of oil falls, the amount of subsidy falls as well. So at present rates, the Central American countries and Caribbean countries would be able to purchase oil for Venezuela and finance about 30% of the purchase cost over the long term. Back when oil was over $100 a barrel, the amount you could finance was between 50 and 60%. So clearly one implication of the fall in the price of oil is that the unsubsidized price of oil today is lower than the subsidized upfront cost for purchasing Venezuelan oil was 2 years ago. And the Central American Caribbean nations that were part of Petrocaribe were able to afford oil back then, so I really don't see the fall of the price of oil today as being a major issue for Petrocaribe countries. They can find alternatives. Now, there are some things about these being particularly small countries that have trouble getting deliveries made by, and so on and so forth, but these are at the margins, issues at the margins. Cuba is a special case because Cuba also refines oil that gets from Venezuela and re-exports it. So presumably this would have an impact on some of Cuba's foreign exchange earnings potential. It's hard to tell how much that is because some of the things that it actually re-exports to other Petrocaribe countries. One of the things that I've argued, actually, a colleague of mine, Ted Picone, and I had argued in a paper last summer, was that, in fact, the Venezuela's economic troubles would probably drive Cuba to look at a reevaluating its international relations, including getting closer to the United States. So we think that this is one of the explanations for the U.S.-Cuba rapprochement, the Cubans realizing they have to diversify their international economic relations.
Thank you. Gentleman there in the aisle.
My name is Kumar from SA Towers. My question is that there is a lot of negative effect on the economies of the oil exporting countries. And I wanted to know, particularly in case of Venezuela, do you see any possibility of IMF intervening in the whole situation and controlling the downward slide of the oil prices and helping the economy of Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela, I think, broke off relations with the IMF, I believe it was in 2007. And so the IMF has not been, what does that really mean? It just means the IMF has not been conducting regular visits or regular evaluations of the Venezuelan economy. That said, the Venezuelan leadership has said over and over again that they will never go to the IMF for bailout. It basically would be a completely counter-revolutionary policy solution for the Venezuelan government, and they've rejected it out of hand. And in fact, the Venezuelan opposition has also thrown out there, has also criticized the government for not because it won't go to the IMF, because of the prospect that it might resort to something like a structural adjustment mechanisms for tactical reasons. They want the current administration to take on the political costs of any economic changes that might happen. So, I mean, I agree with you that the IMF is the organization with sort of the mission and the funding and the expertise to help countries in the kinds of economic straits that Venezuela is right now, but the domestic politics of that makes that unlikely for now.
Thank you. Please, the gentleman over there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cristian Lungarotti from Embassy of Italy. I would like to ask, what do you think will be the impact of this drop of oil prices, or better to say, of energy costs in general, on the energy mix and the investments in renewable energies? Do you see worldwide the trend impacting this sector of investments for the future? Thank you.
Charlie, you want to take that on?
Good question. I don't think it'll have that much impact on renewable energy investments, because I think the growth in the market is A, projected to be overwhelmingly in Asia, and B, projected to be overwhelmingly in transportation fuel demand. Now, I do think there's the prospect that lower gasoline prices, at least in the United States, may have some slowdown impact on how much we move towards the development of electric cars. But again, the electric cars are such a small percentage right now of the total automotive fleet, I don't think it'll be a marginal thing. So I wouldn't anticipate that it has a tremendous impact in the power sector, because in many places in the power sector, it's not so much oil competing against renewables in the United States, it's more gas competing against renewables. Elsewhere in the world, it's more coal competing against renewables. The crash in the price of coal globally right now to levels that we haven't seen in many, many years, I think will be the biggest detriment against renewables in a lot of power markets, minus, you know, countries that have some kind of carbon tax or something discouraging fossil fuel use.
Thank you. Lou, you want
to? So this is a question for Cliff. You know, if you think about Russia, they have, you know, Putin has a lot of control, but there are all these interest groups. There must be concern over middle-class consumers, the Siloviki, and do you see long-term a low oil price scenario generating economic reform within Russia at all? I mean, a lot of the subsidies are going to be harder to keep going. I'm just wondering what those forces and how the competing groups might settle things.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, because I've been trying to formulate in my own mind, on the basis of these debates that are going on, that are very open. I mean, I want to give you an idea, just not directly related to your question, but how these debates are, what plays out. So last week, this 60-point plan I talked about was laid out, and almost all of the items didn't have a price tag attached to them. So there were some that had these enormous price tags. Some of them probably wouldn't cost anything directly. There'd be opportunity costs, but not directly. Anyhow, the government, Medvedev says to his ministers, the two economic ministers, the finance ministry and the Ministry of Economic Development, that they need to go home and figure out how much all this was going to cost. Start off with just what it's going to cost in the rest of the first quarter. We've already finished 1 month, so you got the month of February and March, what it's going to cost. And the Ministry of Economic Development comes back, says it's going to cost 656 billion rubles. Okay. Ministry of Economy, what do you say? It's going to cost 10. That's all you're going to get. You know, and it was all kinds of reasons, partly because you couldn't spend some of this money because the laws don't allow it. You'd have to change the laws and, you know, very, you know, technocratic kind of stuff. But this is the level at which it is, that you've got these hard, unbelievably hard line people in the finance ministry that follow in their mentor, their patron, Alexei Kudrin, who's no longer formally in the government, but is a key advisor to Putin and is a real hardliner. And then the Ministry of Economic Development, which sort of thinks more a little bit in sort of traditional Soviet terms to some extent. So the debate right now is maybe this is the opportunity to push through reforms, because the argument by some people is that this is not just because of sanctions, and it's not just because of the oil price, but it's also because our whole economy was stagnating, it was slowing down already before all of this. And that is true. In 2013, the year 2013, everybody, inside Russia, outside Russia, IMF, World Bank, EBRD, Russian government was predicting 4% growth or something like that for 2013. The figures turned out to be 1.3%. And it had just been on this secular decline after all the oil boom, despite a $100 a barrel oil. So, okay, what are we going to do about it? I think, however, I think what's going on now is a certain jockeying for a situation that has to come when the oil price goes back up. It has to go back. It has to start going back up for any possibility politically for there to be reforms in Russia, because the kind of reforms that Russia needs that would lead to any kind of marginal growth are disruptive, highly disruptive. You're just not going to be able to do those in a situation in which you're very concerned about stability and when people are already suffering. So what now is being done is people staking out the path that needs to be taken once this, if and when this crisis, immediate crisis, is over, both the geopolitical crisis and the market crisis, and then thinking about how to do it in the future. And as I said, they're able to step back and talk about lessons learned from, you know, what happened in 2008, 2009. Lessons learned even about what happened now. I mean, trying to say what was good and what was bad about our oil policy and dependence and rent management, given the sanctions, given the volatility of the oil market. So, these discussions about reforms will probably continue.
Thanks. Do we have more? Yeah, gentleman there.
Back, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Agnes Levy. My question is about the discovery of the oil, exploitation of the oil and shale gas here in the U.S. I'm wondering if it's just followed a natural process, or were it somehow politically or strategically motivated? Thank you.
Well, I don't think it's politically or tactically motivated. I think it's classic market fundamentals. The shale gas and shale oil in the United States is relatively, shale oil is relatively high cost to produce. I do think that the president in his State of the Union address is going down the road to be criticized, because I think it's going to hit a lot harder in the United States economy than he even gave acknowledgement to the prospect of. I think it's very probable that we'll see. The estimates by the state of Texas already are 75,000 people out of work. They're estimating in the Bakken and the adjoining counties that numbers similar to that. I just addressed on Thursday the Association of Western Oil Producers, kind of Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, part of the Bakken, Permian Basin people. They're estimating 150,000 people thrown out of work. And when I say thrown out of work, these aren't guys just drilling the oil rigs. These are people, you know, the oil service companies making the parts and the equipment. And remember that we are the center of the oil service industry. So as oil big capital projects collapse overseas, that throws thousands. Schlumberger has already announced 9,000 people out of work. And then, of course, in these boom towns, all the ancillary industries and small businesses, large businesses that came into service these people, people driving the water trucks for the fracking. This could be an economic crisis in the oil patch that I think could seriously drive down the U.S. economy and certainly not help the Democrats as they look towards the unemployment numbers as we move into 2016. So I for one, think we're vastly underestimating, particularly if I'm right and prices continue at least for a time, a further downward trend. It's a catastrophe in the state of Alaska, you know, where 90-95% of the state's budget comes from oil or oil-related activities. And the president closes off half of Alaska the other day for future oil and gas development, which basically dooms or seriously erodes the prospects of the TAPS pipeline remaining viable because not enough throughput. So I don't think there's any reason to be sanguine that this is great. I know as motorists, we probably all enjoy driving up to the pump and getting our cheap gas, and that is an important factor because that can be a stimulus, of course, to the economy if people spend that saved money at the pump on other goods and services. That could be a redeeming factor offsetting some of these negatives, but I don't think the verdict's home yet on this.
And I will just comment by way of comparison. If you look back to 86, you know, when the perception in places like Iran was at the time that it was a Saudi conspiracy, but a U.S.-Saudi conspiracy, much as the way the Iranians see it today, you know, back in 86, the U.S. was quite concerned about the economic impact on the domestic industry and, in fact, sent then Vice President George Bush out to Riyadh to try to importune the Saudis to lower production to have some kind of an effect on the price crash. So, I think the complications of this are seen very differently depending on where you sit. And while we're here focused on kind of the impact on various countries, there's obviously a huge domestic impact that that often, you know, other players aren't necessarily taking into effect.
So all the way in the back, the gentleman has been, yeah, that's you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff Kupfer. I was just wondering, as the prices have gone down over the last few months, have you noticed any change in U.S. policy towards the countries that you've been talking about, Saudi Arabia for that matter? And if prices stay low, as many believe, do you anticipate any sort of significant changes in how the U.S. is dealing with the relevant countries?
I don't think that you can trace any significant shift in U.S. policy toward the region, toward the Middle East, if you want to think of that as the sort of central player in oil production outcomes. To this current price decline, but I think that it certainly changes American options in dealing with the various crises and obviously puts the Saudis in some respects in a very prime position to have some influence over some of these debates. With respect to Iran, let me just say that, you know, there's a lot of negative for Iran. Probably the most significant negative for the Iranians is that the price drop enables the American political system to debate the application of additional sanctions with slightly less concern about the implications for the global marketplace and by default, slightly less concern about how other players will react. And so, you know, the concerns that we may not be able to sustain the current level of sanctions because of pressures from the oil markets are simply not present at this time. It is, in fact, these sort of oversupply issues that have enabled the very severe sanctions to take effect on Iran without having the blowback at the price we pay at the pump. And, you know, though I am not an advocate of additional sanctions on Iran at this time, I do think that it is quite conceivable that you could take more Iranian exports off the market and not see a significant price rise in the global price of oil.
The other two things that are happening that I think may not get enough attention is, one, some people think the little blip upwards that we've seen in pricing, there have been several factors said to account for that, one being threats by ISIS to some Iraqi fields, but it also appears to be fairly massive stockpiling by the Chinese and to some extent the Indians, obviously buying oil while it's cheap, if you believe it's going, since oil is such a huge cost to their economies because they're overwhelmingly huge importers. And the other factor, two factors I did not mention, further putting pressure on the downside, A, the fact that it still appears, although the data is mixed, it still appears that a lot of hedge fund people are still short on oil, betting the price will go down. And a lot of people think when the price slide began, a lot of the reason it went so far so fast was that the hedge fund guys had gone long, figuring that prices, because of the conflicts in the Middle East, were going to continue to go up. and then the market turned against them, and they had to dump a lot of oil in the market in a quick period of time. And finally, the other issue I don't think has got nearly enough attention is that a lot of governments in the world finally have moved to either reduce or eliminate petroleum subsidies. You've had Indonesia bite a bullet after a long, hard fight and really significantly raise prices, which, of course, means that you won't have the same level of demand. India has taken a very difficult political decision and eliminated diesel fuel subsidies, which is very politically contentious, and begun to eliminate natural gas subsidies. Pakistan's done the same. So as these subsidies get removed, you know, that means there's going to be less demand in a lot of those countries. It's hard to quantify. Is this a huge number, a small number? But it's a fact, and among all these other considerations we've said, that is not good for petroleum prices staying up.
Thanks, Charlie. This way. Gentleman right there.
Yep. Bob Hahn here at Brookings. Two questions. One, how long can the administration resist higher oil prices or oil taxes? And two, we talked about potential stimulus, and you kind of touched on China. How much of a stimulus is this providing to the Chinese economy?
Well, there does appear in the Congress, to some extent on a bipartisan basis, to be serious talk about at least raising the gasoline tax. Whether they have the votes in total to do that or not, but for the first time, you've heard a number of prominent Republicans not oppose that point of view, because, of course, we haven't raised it for years, and this is how, any of you are not familiar, this is how we fund our highway system. So it's long overdue and needs to be done, but remains to be seen. I don't know on China what the numbers are in terms of what the stimulus might be.
No, I don't. Anyone else want to comment on China? I don't think so. No. Okay. Please, yeah. Here in the front.
John Shaga, Strategic Petroleum Consulting. So all of these bad actors seem to be in pretty bad shape, but we're not exactly getting the foreign policy response that we want. So if the White House were actually to ask John Kerry, a year from now, would you like to see the oil price be $60, $40, or $30, what should John Kerry's response to that be?
In arbitrary sequence, Harold, you want to start off?
Well, it's interesting that in fact, the low price of oil, in its sense, has changed the balance in Latin America as a region and its relations with the United States, because high oil prices funded Venezuelan diplomacy in the region. This Petrocaribe organization I spoke about, its relationship with Cuba, which involves a large subsidy from Venezuela for the Cuban economy. Venezuela's relations with Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, other countries that are not that friendly to the United States. So that whole group of Bolivarian countries, so-called, has been, in a sense, weakened their ability to influence political outcomes in the region. So in this sense, a lower price of oil is a relatively good thing for the United States in the region. And we do see a few things happening in this area that shows the U.S. trying to improve relations. So the rapprochement with Cuba, even though it's not related to the drop in the price of oil, after all, those negotiations started over 18 months ago, does mean that at the next Summit of the Americas in Panama in April, there's going to be a better mood for U.S. relations with the region, and the countries that traditionally have been most opposed to U.S. Policy will be in a weaker position because of the not only drop in oil prices, but the general drop in commodity prices has really undercut their ability to be diplomatically influential.
I don't think you can come up with a, you know, sort of optimal price of oil with respect to U.S. interests in the Middle East, because obviously the price fall hurts our adversaries like Iran. It doesn't necessarily make them more pliable at the negotiating table. It may, in fact, induce them to take risky and provocative steps in response. But the oil price drop also hurts our friends, many, if not most of whom, are very highly dependent on oil revenues. Hurts their ability to offset economic crises elsewhere. The Saudis, of course, are a major provider of both resources and capital to a number of what we like to describe as moderate Arab states in the region. The Saudis are also, I wouldn't put them in the moderate category, but are bankrolling in many respects the Egyptian economy as well. And so, you know, to the extent that we see a continuing drop that has some impact on their ability to sustain those revenue streams, I think it obviously is going to create more complications for U.S. foreign policy. To the extent that the price drop has an impact on the provision of subsidies and resources to some of these populations in the region, like the Saudis, as we saw in the 1980s, if it does begin to cut into entitlements for a large and young population in the Arabian Gulf, then I think that some of the implications of the price drop, in fact, are going to be quite negative. So I don't think you can sort of pinpoint a number and say, this is on balance what our hurts our adversaries sufficiently, helps our allies sufficiently. A lot will depend on how the different governments manage this crisis. Obviously, those Arab states in the Gulf that were relatively restrained in the way they managed the price hike of the prior decade are going to be in a better position to ride this out. But I think we're going to see some implications that we don't necessarily predict, as we know in effect from our experience with this in the past.
Is there a magic number for President Putin to come back to the negotiation?
Well, this is kind of the same question as the one about has it changed U.S. policy towards different countries based on the oil price collapse? And, of course, I mean, I would hope that by now we've learned that there's no, that oil price collapse is not a magic bullet against bad guys. That was an idle hope, it seemed to me. So, you know, the real comparison one might try to draw is what happened to the Soviet Union. The conventional wisdom, or common wisdom at least, is that somehow the oil price collapse of the mid-1980s led to the collapse of the whole Soviet Union. But and the oil price, the magnitude of the drop was actually quite similar in terms of percent and time it took to do it. But Soviet Union, there was a case in which maybe more like Iran or Venezuela, a lot of the revenues were being used to subsidize their clients and bad guys around, and they wouldn't have the money to do that. Russia doesn't do that. Russia, this is the fundamental principle of Putin. They said that was a stupid mistake by the Soviet Union to go around spending our money on other people and supporting the Soviet, you know, empire. We won't do that. So it's all Russia first, and therefore that doesn't really work. There's not very much, if any, of Russia's wealth that's being used to subsidize anybody anywhere else, except Eastern Ukraine, which is totally supported by Russian oil and gas subsidies, basically. But they're just, as Harold and Suzanne have explained, there's just too many other complicating factors. I guess it depends on whether we think this John Kerry we're talking about is only looking narrowly at one particular case, disregarding everything Charlie said about the effects on the domestic economy and therefore our ability to conduct foreign policy. It's just, I hope they're not quite that short-sighted, narrow-minded.
Clearly, any of those prices, 40, 50, 60, are very important for some of our strongest allies. Clearly helps the Japanese, clearly helps the South Koreans. Wherever you put China on that continuum, China clearly benefits from the prices they were paying, as do India, a country we're trying to build relations. Brazil might actually make the Nigerians finally have some transparency and actually run their economy instead of ripping it all off like they do. But on the other hand, it's a mixed bag for producers. And keep in mind, I just was looking at some quick figures here. You know, we can take these with a grain of salt. But the EIA, we're at about a 93 million barrel a day oil market today. The EIA still predicts a 119 million barrel market by 2040. Where the devil is that oil going to come if we have at prices 40, 50, or 60? And OPEC itself has numbers even higher than that. So, at some point in time, you've got to have the price that still allows people to go into frontier regions to look for oil and gas, unless you just believe we are in such a structural transformation that these numbers are just pie in the sky.
Thanks. Time for another. Lady right over there.
So I'm Anita Parlow, recently with the Harvard MIT Arctic Fisheries Project. And I wonder, given the comments in terms of structural shifts with respect to Russia when we kind of emerge out of this in terms of sanctions, presumably, and possibly price? Are we going to see a Russia more connected to China and Asia in terms of development and supply? And if so, or even if not so, what might there be implications in terms of U.S. jobs and economy?
I think there's no question that one of the effects of the crisis in Ukraine, more than the oil price collapse, has been Russia looking more seriously in its relationships with China in particular and Asia in general as an alternative to, it's just a way of hedging your bets and diversifying to the east. Is this something permanent and irreversible? That's not necessarily the case, but there is a certain effect momentum that you create. I don't particularly expect it to be a dramatic one, barring a really intense crisis, of course, with Russia and military confrontation with Russia that could just change everything that we've been talking about. And what the effect of that would be on U.S. jobs and the U.S. economy, I'm not sure there would be any great effect. I'd have to think more about what possible ways that could do. It's very difficult for Russia, anything Russia does, to affect the U.S. economy in that way more than creating a nuclear war or something, but in terms of its economic behavior, again, Russia is not a producer of oil and gas that can quickly turn it off and on and affect the world market. It's a free rider on OPEC and keeping them, well, it was when they were keeping the prices high, they were a free rider for a long time. Now they're whatever the opposite of a free rider is, you're suffering these collateral damage and can't do anything about it. So, yes, Russia turns more to the east. It has deeper relations and more diversified relations with countries in Asia, but not so easy to see how that would have a direct impact on U.S. economy, U.S. jobs.
Thanks. We'll take a question more. Gentleman right over here, please.
Thanks. I'm Chi Han from Xinhua News Agency. My question is that we have seen reports that the rig numbers has declined in U.S. very quickly due to the price plummet. So I want to know if the price continue to go down, how much impact toward the U.S. Shale revolution? This is my first question. The second question I want to know is that now for as the oil prices comes down, for most of the economies like the U.S., China, Japan, or Germany, it's a bad news. So those economies may be benefit from the oil prices, so how much they will support the oil prices because their economy may improve on those low-price oil? Thanks.
On the first question of the rig count, I think you have to be very careful because, you know, if you count the number of surface rigs, some of those are literally, when they go down in the ground, some of those are 1, 2, but some of them are 7, 8, 9, 10 lateral rigs. So you've got to look as you hear the Baker Hughes rig count come down, which rigs are coming, and chances are the ones that are coming off are the ones that are least productive. They aren't probably the ones producing at what we call the sweet spot of these shale plays where the highest volume production is. So I just caution you that the rig count needs to be looked at carefully. I don't think if what you're hinting is at any kind of government intervention because of the lower price of oil, I think that's what you were hinting at. We aren't going to see any intervention, at least in the United States, on behalf of the petroleum industry. You know, the very fact that this week we're having debates about how we need to cut the fossil fuel subsidies. So this administration is doing nothing for the fossil fuel industry. Congress may try, but the president will probably veto.
Should it? Should the government actually intervene and do that?
No.
Thanks. We can take one more. Lady here front, you've been very patient.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Ryan with Interfax Energy. And I wondered, Charlie, you mentioned the fact that when you're drilling in the shales. Those wells can go on and off a lot faster than, say, something that's offshore. So I'm wondering, just pursuing what the question here, is the U.S. oil industry, is it poised to play a fundamentally different role than it ever has before? We've been through boom and busts before, but that was with conventional oil drilling, which took more time to come off and more time to come back on. Are we going to see a different pattern this time?
I believe in North America, absolutely we will. Because these wells, as you suggest, Margaret, can be, from what I understand, can be turned off and brought back on 4 to 6 weeks many times, maybe sooner in some cases. So it is a change game as more of our production comes from shale as opposed to conventionals.
All right, thank you. We're close to 3:30 since a couple of us need to go to other places soon after. I would like to leave it at this. I want to thank you all for all your great questions and comments and interventions, and would like to ask you to please join me in thanking our four speakers and our great staff for making this possible.